Welcome, everyone, to the December meeting of the Instructional Leadership Directors Roundtable. I'm Justin Bader with Principal Center, and I'm honored to welcome this month's distinguished guest, Zaretta Hammond. Ms. Hammond is an internationally renowned teacher educator, curriculum developer, and consultant supporting schools in doing deep, instructionally focused equity work. She is the author of Culturally Responsive Teaching and the Brain, Promoting Authentic Engagement and Rigor Among Culturally and Linguistically Diverse Students, which no doubt you have seen around. You may have it on your bookshelf. You may have read it several times. Just a hugely impactful book in our profession. And I'm very excited to have the opportunity to dive in deep and talk about that work today. So Zaretta Hammond, welcome to the roundtable.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here with you.
I've been following your work, more deliberately over the past couple of months, and really have enjoyed diving into the book in recent days. Tell us a little bit about the big picture idea for anyone who is not terribly familiar with the book or the core concepts. What is culturally responsive teaching, and what does that have to do with neuroscience, as you describe in the book?
Yeah, I think it's a really important thing to define it. And I try to do that in Culturally Responsive Teaching the Brain. It's actually one of the reasons that I wrote the book. I started out as a composition teacher and had to figure out how to help my students accelerate their learning. And I started to use these techniques that have been around for a long time. But right now, culturally responsive teaching is kind of like the flavor of the month. Everybody's talking about it. And I do find that there are a lot of misconceptions that get perpetuated because we are talking about it in a way that is very, very narrow. And so one of the things that I have done, I'm going to share my screen because I put a little chart together that helps me talk about what it is and what it isn't. And before I share it, one of the things that typically happens is it gets really narrowed. We think it's about relationships. We think it's about engagement, trying to get students to be engaged or raising self-esteem. These are some of the typical misconceptions. And one of the things I try to do is help people kind of remember how Dr. Gloria Ladson-Billings phrased and framed it, which was around helping students that have been historically marginalized because of, the U.S. Segregation, Jim Crow in schooling, and helping them reclaim that academic prowess. So we really have to help educators who are not that familiar with it really start to understand. So I put a little chart together and let me just share it here. I think you can see my screen now. And part of what it is distinguishing it from multicultural, social justice, and culturally responsive. Because one of the biggest challenges I see is people use these interchangeably, right? Now they just want to slap culturally responsive education or teaching on everything, kind of like gluten-free these days, right? Ketchup, gluten-free. Well, it was always gluten-free. So the reality is we need to do a better job, particularly as leaders, to distinguish. So let's just take the first one on the left, multicultural education. Now, it's an important thing, but it does not actually add up to being culturally responsive. This is where diversity and inclusion efforts fit in. And the watchwords there are social harmony. Then you have, let me go to the social justice, right? Anti-racist efforts live here. Now that's very popular because of all of the uprising and unrest this summer and past year around George Floyd and the call for anti-racism and anti-racist education. This is where we're talking about raising critical consciousness and putting more social justice themes in our curriculum and our lessons. And that is about critical consciousness. Now, here's what's really important to understand about these first two. Multicultural education is about people getting along better, and that's an important piece. Social justice education is about raising consciousness, but neither one of those improve academic outcomes. So they may improve some conditions that create the opportunity for instruction to be improved, but it does not improve instruction. So if a student's behind in reading, it does not in any way help with acceleration. And that's where culturally responsive education comes. It is focused on acceleration, helping the student grow their brain power. That's the connection to neuroscience. So all of what we know about the science of learning has always been embedded in culturally responsive education. Dr. Asa Hilliard talked about this at least two, almost three decades ago, probably more than three decades ago. He started talking about this in the late 60s, early 70s. So a lot of this research has always been out there, but bringing it all together is what Dr. Latz and Billings did. And that really is about how do we help students build their independence as learners, meaning their cognition, not just compliance, because that's the other part I find is really confused with culturally responsive. I'm gonna stop sharing this right now so I can be back with you. But those three are typically things that get interchanged and it gets confused and conflated with anti-racist education. And consequently, if a leader kind of latches on to kind of one of those, oh, it's about food, fabric, and festivals, then we'll go down the wrong path, right, as a school. And consequently, one of the things that you start to see is people lose faith in, oh, this doesn't work, because their mental models of what this is are skewed toward just relationships or multiculturalism. I'll pause there because I have so much I could say. That's why I wrote the book.
Absolutely, absolutely. And and definitely there's far more in the book than we can get into today. But one statement that you make, I believe early on in the book, is that culturally responsive teaching is a mindset. Do I have that right? And I know it's more than that, but is that an accurate statement that there's a big mindset component?
I think it's a mental model. Let's get really clear, because one of the things I see confusing, getting confused in how people are leading this work is they think it's synonymous with implicit bias training. Meaning we need to get teachers together, we need to help change their mindset. But here's the thing that we understand about adult learners. We learn by doing. We don't learn because somebody says change your mindset. And changing your mindset is not synonymous with implicit bias training. So we see a lot of folks going down this road, right? A lot of leaders think that's what we have to do. We got to get all the people together, particularly if we have predominantly white educators teaching a growing population of Black and Brown students. Then what we fall into is the trap of, oh, it's about mindset shifts. So I prefer to use the words mental model. Why? When you talk about systems thinking, at the bottom of that system is the mental models, the shared language, the shared understanding of what this is and what this isn't, not just do you have bias or not. So there's a way in which leaders have to be more nuanced in how they understand the mechanisms that actually produce a particular outcome. Just because you can say the words culturally responsive doesn't mean you know a damn thing about how to get to that.
Right. There's a practice component, right? We have to have actual practices and not just ways of, you know,
well, more so than just attitudes. Because we'll fall into the trap of strategies. Then it becomes about strategies. So now we're into it's mindset, it's strategies. That is called it's not effective, you know, versus understanding what your theory of change is, because you understand systems thinking, because you actually understand the mental models. You know, I wrote a chapter for John Hattie in the 10 Mind Frames book, and it was around this very thing. How do leaders have to help adults really get what it is and not allow people to fall back into, I say it's this, you say it's that, and we're gonna do this because this makes us comfortable. Versus what do we understand about the science of learning that allows us to use culture as a cognitive scaffold? But a good portion of white educators, just like white people in America, don't necessarily have interactions with communities of color. Consequently, they don't necessarily have that bicultural lens. So how do you use culture as a cognitive scaffold helping to accelerate if you don't have any other interaction, if you don't know what that is, then you're making things up. That's how we fall into the bucket of multiculturalism. My point is, this is much more nuanced work than people actually take it as. They think it's a bucket of strategies that are called culturally responsive, and they don't break it down further than that. And so it's like a bad case of telephone. We're now doing things that are actually harmful to children under the guise of social justice.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the telephone aspect, because I feel like there's a tendency in our profession to hear a good idea, maybe first or second hand, and then share that good idea. But by the time it gets to the classroom, maybe the classroom teacher did not hear it firsthand or secondhand or even third hand. And there's a process of, you know, as in the game of telephone, of, you know, simplifying and oversimplifying and leaving things out that really are critical. And, you know, to talk about any one piece in isolation seems like it kind of breaks the whole functioning. So maybe set up some for us some of the other key kind of understandings when we're talking about culturally responsive teaching. It's not just an attitude or a mindset. It's not just a set of techniques. What are some of the other big pieces that people should understand as they dive in?
Right. Here's the thing that I say when I am, you know, supporting instructional coaches or leaders or even teachers, and each one has a different role to play. I think of it as a relay race, right? You run your leg of the race and you have a baton that has to be passed on. So each person, given their role, is going to have a really important understanding of how the whole works. Everybody has to have that shared understanding. That's a theory of change. That's core mental models that they share, so that when they run their leg of the race, they'll know what it is they're setting the next group up. So a leader knows where we're going with this. And again, we're not just kind of going down the road of, hey, we're all going to do this one strategy. And that's what I see a lot. So even if it doesn't go down the road of, you know, telephone, bad idea, I went to a conference and somebody gave me a handout. And here's the thing I'm going to say, and this may sound really, you know, harsh. That's the only word I can think of it. If you're doing that, you're unwittingly contributing to inequity. And if that's not where your heart is, if that's not your intention, then you need to not do that. Doctors don't do that. Lawyers don't do that. At least the good ones don't, right? I heard this thing. No, you go to the law books, you write down the precedent or the code or whatever, and it has numbers so you can refer people back to it. It actually has, no, it was so-and-so v. so-and-so on this time. Why? Why do we do that? But in education, you can hear some half-assed thing at a conference, bring it back, try it. Oh, because it's a technique. And so one of the things that I see, and this is particularly from those of us who, you know, we have a heart for social justice, but we don't necessarily do the work of on the ground, the science of learning. So the key thing that we need to understand is it's not just making our lessons more diverse. The student is a unit of change. How are we helping the student become a more powerful learner, not a more compliant learner? Because what I see a lot is people mistake when I say dependent and independent learners for an independent learner is a compliant learner. And this is particularly true. The poorer the children, the blacker and the browner they are, then it comes to a pedagogy of compliance. Versus what we actually need to do is have more of a pedagogy of innovation that allows students to harness their natural learning ability. Every brain learns. And the only way we get better is to actually engage in productive struggle. But if you look into classrooms, the pedagogy of compliance is so strong that we tell students when they can turn and talk and when they need to stop talking. And then we penalize them if their natural curiosity, their intellectual curiosity gets fired up. What do? We shut it down. Hey, I see you talking over there. Versus, what is exciting you right now? We reserve that for honors. We reserve that for, and guess, look to see who's in those classes. I don't care if it's remote, and I don't care if it's in person. And the children that aren't showing up for remote learning are voting with their cameras. So people keep talking about relationships. Well, what it's showing you is you haven't invested the right amount of time and energy in building authentic relationships. Not just, how are you? We're gonna have 15 minutes and then we're gonna go back to doing the thing we did. Building the kind of relationship that gets students to accelerate their learning is by being shoulder to shoulder with them. In the book, I talk about this as building an alliance. And something really interesting happens when you build that alliance. I mean, we're in this together, right? Think Mr. Miyagi and Karate Kid. Then what happens is that child reveals to you their vulnerability, where they are struggling with learning, and they will ask your advice. Kids will give you permission to push them when they think you are on their team. And on their team doesn't just mean, oh, we have a good relationship and rapport. What it means is, I am giving you coaching advice. This is where you're hitting it and you're killing it because it's great. Here's where you still need to work on this. Right? And that progress principle, again, neuroscience, the brain loves to know it's getting better. That's why we wear Fitbits and pedometers and want to know all our metrics. Well, we don't do that in school. We don't give students ownership of their learning, not by throwing them in the deep end, but by coaching them in how to learn beginning in first grade. Then we get to sixth and seventh grade and say, you need to be an independent learner. Well, we've taught them how not to be.
I really appreciate that contrast between the compliance, you know, kind of understanding of dependent versus independent, and your clarification that this is not about compliance. This is about the intellectual engagement and the intellectual work that students need to do. And you talk in the book about building intellective capacity. What does that mean, and what does it look like as students progress through school? Especially, I'm thinking about in the upper grades where teachers may feel like, you know, students were not properly served when they were younger and are, you know, there's a temptation to give lower level work, to give more basic work, and to not give opportunities to do higher order thinking. What does it mean to build that intellective capacity?
So here's a challenge, right? And this is more than we could cover in this show, because that's a great question. One of the things that I say is you have to figure out how to stimulate intellectual curiosity. This is why improving information processing is the key, not just calling everything culturally responsive. Like I said, just because you can say the words doesn't mean that you're helping a student level up. Just because you're bringing in more texts with brown faces doesn't mean anything is going to change if that student still doesn't know how long vowels work. So people need to get really real about what it is they're attempting to do. So this idea of building intellectual capacity, or as it was called, intellective capacity, is really the connection to the neuroscience that I try to elevate for folks and to kind of really draw out. This is what the science of learning and the science of reading is bringing out right now, that you have to, in order to carry more of the cognitive load, you have to help students actually build those structures in their head. Now, the challenge is people will hear that and like, tell me the technique to do it. Well, it's not a technique. It's like saying, I want to run a marathon. I went and registered. They gave me my little number to pin on my jersey. And I'm going to go sit on the couch for the next 5 months. Well, I can pretty much guarantee you try to run those 26 miles and you're going to have a heart attack. That's the same as trying to build students what I call learning muscles. Right? How are you engaging them in the academic challenge? And it can't be, I'm going to give you the rigorous work, and I've never given you that rigorous work, because this is where the mindset work comes in. If the student hasn't been successful, then they are going to internalize that message. If you add to that the narratives of racial difference that marginalize Black and brown kids as not being smart enough, or because you have an accent or your mother tongue is Spanish, we don't do that for French and Italian, but if it's Spanish, then somehow you're less intelligent. These are the racial narratives that are part of the water we drink in America, because we are a country born of apartheid. That is, we had functional apartheid until 52 years ago, according to one of our national historians, John Meacham. So people have to get real about how we help students kind of push back counter narratives on those narratives about who they are and what they can do. Now, here's the challenge. If you're a white educator who is not really interacted, this is not a pep talk. you are going to have to build a different type of capacity to help students actually do that. If you don't know what those narratives are, how are you going to help them build a counter narrative? This is where growing ourselves is a really important part of helping students grow their intellectual capacity. It's not a technique. I get to be who I am, white progressive educator, leader, whoever I am, and I'm going to just do this thing that's called culturally responsive. It's not a treatment. Black and brown children aren't broken. But here's the thing about it. You want test scores to go up, you are going to actually have to help students build their learning muscles. Learning gaps turn into opportunity gaps, turn into achievement gaps. Learning gap, if I don't know with automaticity my multiplication tables, guess what? Sixth grade, seventh, eighth grade, I can't take algebra. Guess what? That's going to show up in the test scores. So this quick fix, culturally responsive teaching is not a quick fix. Actually, it's just the opposite. When done well, it is something you have to commit a few years to so you can build this capacity. It's not about exposing children to culture, right? That's not what we're talking about here. That's multiculturalism, and that's cool, but that is not going to raise anybody's intellectual capacity. I'll pause there because I can go on and on.
Well, I wanted to share a couple of things from the chat comments that are coming in. Several requests to share more of this, and if you do a daily podcast, that would be warmly received by people who would love to hear from you on a regular basis. Yeah, definitely. This desire for a quick fix, you know, we talked about that a little bit earlier when it comes to, you know, conferences. Like I've been at conferences both as a presenter and attendee where, you know, like I'll go attend someone else's session and I'll see people walk in and just grab the handouts and then leave. Really? And think, how are you going to implement that if you didn't hear the session? And sometimes we do want that, you know, I've got your graphic printed out here. Yeah. And we want that to be the whole thing. Like, okay, I'll just do this tomorrow and we'll be in great shape. I feel like sometimes the handout needs to say, read the entire book and spend 2 years studying yourself and how you can implement it. Because that, what I'm hearing you say is that is the answer, that this is deep work, that this is long-term work, this is not a quick fix.
That's right. And here's the thing about it. Even the book is not, it's the way I write. When I was in a classroom, I taught composition. I love writing. I love teaching writing. Everybody should love writing. Unfortunately, that's not the case in school. But the reason I wrote the book was I wanted people to understand how all the dots were connected. It's not an implementation manual. Now, what I see people is, oh, we've been using your book for 2 years. I'm thinking, what the hell are you doing with the book? It wasn't written. I mean, it's practical, but okay, those two things, practical things I mentioned, oh, there are 20 other days in the month, you know, or there's so much more. But at the end of this, I'll share with folks about kind of the online PLC I've put together, because there is so much more. I envision the book, Culturally Responsive Teaching the Brain, as the first part of what Ferrere calls praxis, right? He says, understanding, conceptual understanding, informed action, and then reflection. So those are three important parts. I do work helping leaders really understand, how do you build your capacity to lead this work? Because just helping people pick a so-called strategy isn't it. How do instructional coaches coach teachers so those teachers can level up and become coaches to the students, the personal trainer of students' cognitive development? There's so much more to that implementation. What we have right now is an implementation gap being fueled by this so-called urgency. Because every time I say that to people, well, we need something right now because we're urgent. Well, look where urgency has gotten you, because you're still in the same boat. There's no rise in test scores. The gaps are getting even wider. So people are making up a narrative as to why those children are still at the bottom of the achievement curve. And it's not a good narrative, because they're not taking ownership. Well, we're spending money. We're doing these new initiatives. It must be those kids. It must be those families. So this sense of urgency is actually working against equity in schools.
That's an interesting kind of tension, because we want the motivation to be there. We want people to take these challenges seriously and not put them on the back burner, say, yeah, we'll get to that in the future. But we also want people to recognize that this is long-term work. There is, is not a one-page handout that will get us there. Lots of great questions coming in, and I have lots of questions that I want to ask, but I want to share a couple of these. Fabrice asks if you could expand on the statement, turning concepts into practices takes focus, feedback, and reflections. And actually, this is a good opportunity to ask. You have been working with a cohort in depth over the last couple of months, and I assume this is the first cohort that has been largely fully remote. I know you've been a consultant for several decades now, and have taken many schools and leaders and educators through this material and through this work. But what have you seen happen in that cohort that you've been working with this year?
Yeah, so here's the thing. I just want to clarify that. Before I created CRE by design, culturally responsive education by design, and I created it as an online platform, an online professional learning community. And I did that because even before the pandemic, I stopped doing one shot, come do a training for our school. Because what people were doing is they were mistaking information for transformation. Oh, I sat there and I went to a training, and you don't change a damn thing in your classroom. That's not a training, that's I heard some stuff, right? And so now we're giving equity a bad name because that's what we're thinking. Then what's happening is people are looking for racialized stuff. Now, if I'm talking about learning muscles, well, how is that related? Because it doesn't sound racialized. So now they've kind of kicked themselves into the multicultural bucket again. So I just stopped doing that because I'm not going to contribute to people think they're helping when they're harming children. Instead, I built something that's online for people who are serious and want to go in depth, knowing we go slow to go fast. We have several what we call core tenets, and we ground ourselves in the instructional core that Richard Elmore talks about, right? The teacher, the student, the content. He talks about them always being in a dynamic dance. And what they get is a combination of synchronous and asynchronous. So what that has been doing is it slows them down long enough to get ahas about their own mental models, as well as to look at what narratives are in their school. Then what we do is we start to say what conditions need to be shifted. Then we slowly start making those changes in the classroom, right? And the classroom doesn't matter if it's in person or remote. If you call yourself teaching something, then these principles apply. Neuroscience didn't stop being relevant neuroscience because now we went to remote. We have just been doing things one way, and we think that is the way, and that's only working for a very narrow band of kids, very narrow, that even there are white children that maybe come from low-income families that still need to build their learning muscles. So this idea that we have, you know, this urgency, that means we just have to do this. So I'm learning a lot about what they're learning, what surprises them, where it's hard. They continue to remind themselves, oh, we have to go slow, because they bump up against their own mental models, right? And that is our challenge, is how do we actually get to what will make the change?
Love it. This is a little bit out of left field, but something you just said sparked this this recollection of I think something very important you say in the book, that when you're talking about students from poverty, you say in the book that poverty is not a culture. What does that mean?
It means that a lot of people drink the Ruby Payne Kool-Aid out there, which is for a long time, and Ruby's back, with the notion that we have to learn how to teach students who live in poverty. So the notion became, again, as you said, the shorthand for that is, oh, you know, those families, that's their culture. So if I learn about how you live and navigate poverty, then I'm being culturally responsive. When we understand how racial and class stratification happens in America, we understand nobody's choosing poverty. Nobody says, hey, you know, rather than be like those Rockefellers and go for generational wealth, we are going to flip the script and go for generational poverty. No one ever says that. You are caught in a loop until you can get yourself out of that. And education has always been one of the ways poor people, Black people, Indigenous people, brown people have always lifted themselves out, even when that education was kept from them. Slaves taught themselves to read with sticks and dirt. So the reality is that is being perpetuated by white progressive educators as somehow, you know, those families, and it's a very paternalistic and a very negative view of that capacity, but it ties into one of the narratives of racial difference. That narrative being those people, Black and brown people, are not motivated for betterment. This is perpetuated in popular culture and in the way media, you can even look at it in advertising. It's a trope. And unfortunately, it's a trope that has been part of the educational landscape for a long time, right? So being able to understand how people start talking about poverty is somehow that's just what they want to do, versus people are caught in a cycle. So this is where I think Karen Mapp's work really is very positive. She talks about dual capacity, and you can check out her work at dualcapacity.org, where she talks about parents and teachers coming to way, parents and schools coming together in a new way to build partnerships. So when I talk about learning partnerships with students, meaning before you can actually help the student take on rigorous work, you have to have this learning partnership, not just a good relationship, this learning partnership. You have to have a partnership with parents. Not that you need to teach parents, but you have to recognize and respect them as children's first teacher. If children are coming to school potty trained, walking and talking, parents may not know the word pedagogy, but they know what that is. And we don't give them the respect, particularly if those parents were educated and undereducated and miseducated in the same schools. Now, no wonder they come up there mad, because they know what's happening, because they experience the same trauma. So a lot of trauma-informed practice gets conflated as culturally responsive. You know, Black and brown people's lives did not start with slavery or genocide or whatever the civil rights thing is. But unfortunately, the predominant white theme is that's actually what happened. So now what we get is this kind of paternalistic, oh, everybody's just, you know, in poverty, or everybody has trauma. Trauma is real, but I will also say a lot of that trauma is inflicted inside the school. And that's something we're not coming to grips with, because it's subtle. Microaggressions are allowed to flourish. And it's not because someone's being directly mean. It's that unexamined way in which students don't feel a sense of belonging. Parents don't feel a sense of belonging. Things aren't accommodating different cultural ways of being and doing.
Yeah, that's a really good point for me to ask this that I wanted to get to about threat. And a lot of what you talk about from the neuroscience specifically of the, you know, the lizard brain, the lower brain, and our kind of threat detection systems. How does threat, I think this will be my last question, then I'd love for you to take a look at the chat questions, because so many are good, and I think you should be the one to choose which questions to address. But could you talk just about threat and that sense of threat that you know, that students can experience in school, and how that plays in?
Yeah, I think one of the first thing is you have to understand the neuroscience. And this is why I start the book with, you know, two chapters of kind of neuroscience. And I give people the, you know, the heads up, like, get your highlighter out. We're about to kind of go, you know, I'm about to geek out on a little neuroscience. Because if you don't understand about the amygdala and what triggers the amygdala and the counterbalance to the neuroscience of connection and the neuroscience of intellectual curiosity and engagement, dopamine system, the oxytocin system with the vagus nerve, if you don't understand these, you don't understand that the amygdala generates cortisol. And if too much cortisol is present, it shuts down any sense of belonging that oxytocin could bring. It shuts down any intellectual engagement that dopamine would stimulate. And what we don't understand is a lot of the ways that we interact with children as adults generate this sense of threat. And students may not seem like they're feeling threatened on the surface, but their brain is experiencing this as a hostile environment. You see this with a lot of our English language learners, very compliant. And that's called the appease, meaning if I get really small, quiet, I'm just not gonna make no trouble. That on the surface doesn't look like that student is feeling threatened, but that's the brain's response. So what's happening is the student is so worried about maintaining that so as not to, kind of like the possum, let's just play dead over here, right? And cortisol is pumping out, meaning I can look like I'm paying attention to that lesson, but nothing's sticking. And we want to make content sticky. We want the experience to be that the student turns inert information into usable knowledge. That requires the student to be brain to be calm and ready, relaxed, but alert, and the right mix of that. Now, that's the first part of being culturally responsive. I have to understand what gets the student's alarms going off. And I have to create a classroom environment, not one child at a time, but as an environment. When you walk through the door, you know if a place is feeling hostile, if it's feeling welcoming or not. And this is not about, oh, we're going to do 15 minutes of SEL at the start of the school day. That is another trap we fall into, because SEL should be something, social emotional learning and development, that is integrated into the learning episode. So when I'm feeling hesitant, or I'm feeling like, oh, I can't do this, that's when we have to apply our understanding of social emotional development so we can help the student re-regulate those emotions, right? Lower your cortisol, up your dopamine, even out your oxytocin. You need a little cortisol in there. So we're not talking about flatlining, right? But my point is, we want to racialize culturally responsive teaching as I'm always talking about issues of race or diversity. We don't want to talk about it neuroscience. So I don't need to racialize that. I just need to understand how a microaggression actually might be creating that. And if I don't understand what a microaggression looks like, and I'm asking you, where are you from? This is a quick example. I had a student, a participant in a workshop. He was Asian, and he was paired with white educator. And the white educator asked him, oh, where are you from? Because he, I guess, looked Asian. The guy says, what do you mean? He's like, oh, where are you from? He says, I'm from Cleveland. And the guy says, no, where are you from? And he's like, what you talking about? I am three generations deep from Ohio. Because this is a microaggression. Most white educators wouldn't know that kind of subtle microaggression. So this idea of creating a hostile environment may not seem like hostile words, but if leaders don't know how to create that environment, helping other adults who are in charge create that for adults and kids and parents, then everybody's just going to go to their corners and be on alert. So when we talk about the amygdala, there's so much that is connected to making sure that the environment has those low stressors. Low stress, high trust.
Love it. Well, again, I could ask questions all day, but I want to turn it over now to the chat. Are you able to see the chat on your end?
And there's a lot of stuff in there.
So, yeah. So why don't you pick? Right. Yeah. Why don't you pick where to focus for the remainder of our time, so I don't hog it all with my questions. So many good questions have come in, and thank you everyone for your wonderful questions.
There's some testifying. Amen to SEL integrated. Absolutely. So I'm going to go from the bottom to the top. So I will apologize to those people put in questions earlier. This question says, what would you say to teachers in selective schools who are resistant to this idea, especially in STEM and a school with a small Black and Brown population? So part of what you have to understand is what is the purpose of culturally responsive teaching? So what I try to help people understand is culturally responsive teaching is when you have a sizable Black and Brown population that are always at the bottom of your achievement gap, and you need to turn that around. You need to make sure they're not chronically there. They are represented across all achievement bands in their proportion in the population. Now, when you get to, I've worked a lot with independent schools, selective white your private, call them what you want to call them, who then admit a few Black and brown kids. We work at a different level because this work of culturally responsive teaching isn't what they need. And therein lies the problem. They think, oh, we just need to be culturally responsive. When the reality is you really need to look at first your admissions policy, because a lot of independent schools are letting kids in that they know are underperforming already, trying to up their diversity. So on the backs of Black and brown families, they're letting kids in that they know are going to struggle a bit. And there's no other way. And if they create something, they're going to stigmatize those kids. That whole thing is really deep, right? So I don't want to go too deep into it, but what I want you to understand is if you have predominantly white schools, you need a different thing. Culturally responsive teaching isn't the thing you need. You need more anti-racism education, so people really understand how they're creating a hostile environment or an environment of belonging for whoever comes in. All right, Karen Mapp. Teresa's like, dual capacity by Karen who? Karen Mapp, M-A-P-P. All right. Let's see. Misacknowledged per, okay. How does critical race theory impact culturally responsive teaching? So here's the thing I want you to understand. These aren't two different theories. Critical race theory says that racism, as because of who we are, born of apartheid, will always be there. So once you take that as a presupposition, then you can start understanding culturally responsive teaching. So it's not, these things don't sit on an even keel. Critical race theory is the bedrock of which all things equity centered actually focuses on. So it's really important for people to start understanding all these different terms that they hear, so they see how they actually do that and how those things fit together. That's an important question. Thank you for that. How can we join your cohort? Well, you can check it out at, I'm going to give you the link later, but CREbydesign.com, and that you can learn more there. Decentralization of race so that we focus on a common ground, i.e. learning gap. No, I am not talking about decentralizing race because we cannot. We are a country born of apartheid. Race was all in the center of it. What I'm suggesting is we understand that inequity by design centered specifically on undereducating and underdeveloping the cognitive capacity of certain children, certain people, Black and brown people to be specific, indigenous people. So when you understand that is what inequity is, then you know that equity has to focus on refocusing on developing the cognitive capacity. So this is not like, oh, we're just gonna be neutral and just help everybody be a better learner, because that's not what happens in America. This is hardwired into what public education is. Just look at segregation. It wasn't just, oh, let kids in. Well, you've undereducated them for a long time. So we're not decentralizing race. I'm gonna say that over and over again. We're actually centralizing it, but we're also centralizing what whiteness is in the sense that we get to build our cognitive capacity if we're white. If we're not, then we focus on underdeveloping. All you need to do is look at how reading instruction falls out in our education system. Justin, jump in here because I'm looking at a lot of comments and I just want to like lean into all of them. oh, wow. Bill asks a great question. What are two books on her bookshelf she would suggest we read? Lord, I could go so deep into that. Here's the thing I will say, Bill, that I read books that are, again, if you want to get better at equity, if you want to get better at helping students accelerate their learning, particularly students that have been marginalized, then part of what you have to better understand is, well, how is this work actually happening? So I love the work out of Project Zero, right? Ron Rickhart's work around making thinking visible. But if you actually read his earlier book, it's called Intellectual Character. And what he's talking about is this idea of how do you help the student build an academic mindset, not like growth mindset, right? Or grit, because a lot of times that we just tell a kid, get a growth mindset, like, you know, you can go over to CVS and get that on aisle 3A. But this is about how do you help a student actually see their capacity. Here's the thing to remember, competence precedes confidence. So we keep trying to get students to feel more confident. The only way anybody feels more confident is because they have more success at their competence, right? So one of the things I love is where the neuroscience, the other is the social neuroscience of education. Lou, I can't even think of Lou's last name right now, begins with a C, C-O-N something. Those two are really good. Let's see. Yes, we've used a book as a book study. It's amazing. I have a lot of things to say about a book study. People doing book studies on the book. Again, information is not transformation. I'll leave it at that. What resources can you suggest for leadership teams to work on the work? Oh, wow. This is where I'm at right now. I'm working on my next book. I got two actually at the same time. My publisher is like, okay, you need to finish that book. And I am. Next year is my writing sabbatical. But I'm actually working on some work with leaders to actually help them understand how they need to shift and change. There are a couple of things. Again, I don't have too much time. I'd love to. All right, I'm going to stop there because these are just so rich. And I will just go down the wormhole.
Yeah, well, let's give people one more chance. If you know, if you have a burning question that that you want to pop in the chat, go ahead and do that. In the meantime, Zaretta, do you want to pull up your website and talk a little bit more about the CRE by Design PLC? Because I think people are hungry for that transformation and wanting to do more than a book study.
Absolutely. And here I'm going to put a couple of things in the. In the chat here. This is the distinctions of equity piece, just so that you have that. And
so that's here. The handout that you showed toward the beginning, right?
That we had. Great. I just wanted to make sure that you got it.
Thank you.
Here is another article that I really want you guys to have before we, well, actually two I'm gonna give you. And then I will talk about the other, because I really came just to talk, you know, I am passionate about talking about this subject, not necessarily selling the PLC. But, you know, I welcome anybody who wants to join me and some other folks. And we just opened registration the other day. So it's the real timely point, if indeed you're ready, which more of that will happen. So what I put in the chat, article I wrote around culturally responsive teaching in a remote distance learning environment for KQED here in the San Francisco Bay Area, their mind shift. And there was another article just coming out from a professor at Harvard, and he talks about equity work, too much talk, not enough action. So for leaders, I think this is a really, really critical piece. And someone is saying, you know, we're doing a book study currently. How do you recommend starting the hard conversations with staff who are somehow reluctant? So here's the thing that I want to say, and then I'll talk about the PLC. One of the things that I see is leaders and instructional coaches start in the wrong place. They start with, let's have this hard conversation about anti-racism and why this is important. And what they get is this resistance, because white people hear that, their amygdala hears that and says, are you calling me a racist? And they may not say it out loud, but that's what that resistance is. So instead of kind of, I call it, you have to anchor and twist. You have to anchor in what is everybody concerned about? We want all our students to be powerful learners. Where is it that it's not happening? So a lot of the work that I do when I'm working with teams, particularly leadership teams, is this, where do we start? The PLC though is a, and I'm gonna write it, just put the bydesign.com right here for you all. You can find your way there. And the page is there to help you, registration page, to get more information. I did an informational webinar. So in the middle of the page, you're gonna see my little video pop-up. Right above that, if you click it, you can go to the informational webinar that I did that gives you more background, what's inside it, so that you get that information. But again, it's not for folks that are just starting. It's for folks who want to build their capacity, because it's not a, you know, I'm going to download some lesson plans and no, it's going to teach you the design principles so you actually can serve the students that are relevant. You know, they're using the book in Australia, New Zealand, India. Why are they using it in all these disparate places? Because it's not just like formulaic. It's around the design principles that connect to the science of learning and neuroscience, so that wherever there is colonization, and we know that colonization works because the education system is designed to marginalize. So to reverse that, there are certain things we have to do. We have to help students accelerate, because generationally they come in behind, not because they want to, but because this is how the system has set it up. So I think one of the biggest things is we start in the wrong place. We want people to have hard conversations, but we have to first help them with coming into understanding. Here's our shared understanding of what the current issues are. I call this assess current reality, right? What is the problem? And to see what narratives, why are we saying that? Let's first own that whatever's happening, we are creating it. Systems produce, the outcomes are the things that systems produce. They're designed to produce. If that's not what you want to produce, you have to change the system. You can't get new kids. I'm going to leave it there because I know I could go on and on. Someone asked, is there a cohort? Yeah, the last one is going to be January 18th. Registration is open now. And once that's done, I am going to finish writing this next book. And then it will be back January 2022. Now, that seems so far in the future, but the reality is it's a year away. So folks will have 5 months. They'll have access to all the asynchronous content. And then every Thursday in the month, they have access to me. We have Q&A. I do an on-demand membership that is centered around remote learning. So even though we're learning design principles, for that Thursday, the first Thursday of every month, we focus on making sure people are still getting support around remote learning. There's a space for leaders. There's a space for instructional coaches where they get a little additional content. We have a national board certified educator and consultant who is really skilled around inquiry, leading us on the third Thursdays for people who really want to do more structured lesson study or cycles of inquiry. So we try to balance it between people who feel like, oh, I can do this in a more self-paced way, and other people who really need that team structure. And then we have a forum where you can post questions, share your progress. So we try to build the best of that in this kind of virtual world.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Yeah, people are asking, Kira's asking, is it possible to join as a team? Can principals participate? I think you addressed that a little bit, but yeah, you have teams going through?
Yeah, we have teams going through, right? The next iteration is going to be all teams. Right now, individual teachers. I strongly suggest people come in with at least a partner, right? If you come, I have a few school teams, right? They get to talk to each other. There is a space in the forum where they can create their own, we call them community of practice. So their own little place where they have their own private, you know, for lack of a better word, which you might see on Facebook group, but it's on our private platform where it's their own little group with their members where they can actually keep in contact with each other. And now that's so much more important because a lot of us are in, you know, remote. So we don't see our colleagues face-to-face all the time. So this is a place where they can at least have that asynchronous conversation.
Wonderful. So the website is CRE, Culturally Responsive Education, bydesign.com. You've got a cohort starting in mid-January, and people can learn more about registering themselves, registering their team. One thing I want to mention, because I know, you know, people want to engage with this at different levels. I have to say, I've really been enjoying both the book and the audiobook. So if you are a treadmill person or a exercise bike person or just have stuff you're doing around the house. Not many books in our profession are available on audio. So I just wanted to say thank you for making that available as another way for people to engage. I highly recommend that and digging in. And I appreciate, Zaretta, your continued pushback on any attempt to oversimplify or reduce to just kind of one thing. So many powerful takeaways. Let me ask people, because there are many individual things that people are taking away from this. If you would share in the chat, what were some of your key takeaways from today? I would love to hear in the chat, what were your takeaways from our time today? Yeah, CREbydesign.com. I'll put that in the chat again, because people are asking.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and type it. Okay. There it is, CREbydesign.com.
Thank you.
And if leaders want to come in, they should come in as at the coach level. And there is going to be a space for leaders. So I saw that one. Yes, don't mistake information for transformation. If you can take anything away, right, that we actually have to do the work. I love these, the difference between independence. Yes, learning partnerships. Students, the unit of change.
So many good takeaways here. How do we get all classes to look like an honors classroom?
Absolutely.
Good deal. All right, final word.
I just appreciate everybody who's holding it down during remote learning. Here's the thing I do want people to remember. Crisis brings opportunity. As much as this is challenging us, it's actually opening up a portal for us to think about our pedagogy in a new way. And we don't have to go back to what we used to do. This is actually the opportunity to reimagine, not just because we want to put innovation, but we want to serve the students who have historically been underserved. So I think that this is an opportunity in the midst of. It's a gift that the crisis gives us. In the meantime, I want everybody to stay as healthy as possible. You know, hashtag come on with that vaccine already. Because children need us. They need to be with each other. We are human. We are social animals as humans. In the meantime, I'd really want people just to continue to think about go slow to go fast.
Go slow to go fast. Love it. Well, thank you, Zaretta Hammond. Thank you so much for joining us for the roundtable and sharing your work. And being willing to take those hard questions and go deep with them. And I think that's my challenge that I'm taking away is don't try to just extract one little thing, one little takeaway, but really be willing to go deep to address some of our biggest challenges as a profession.
Thank you, Justin, for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. And thank you everyone for joining us. We'll call it good here. Have a great day.
All right.
Bye-bye. Thanks so much.